again. Somebody asked this after the last session. We've done two kinds of variation, right? The first one, in showing this was a symmetry, we varied the action with epsilon constant. And then we said that delta S equals zero without using the equations of motion. So that was the definition of a symmetry, is that when you vary the action with epsilon equals constant, the variation is zero independent of the equations of motion. That's the definition of a symmetry. The second variation we did is to say, given this situation, given that it's a symmetry, let's now make epsilon a function of time. And now we'll vary the action, but this time argue that the variation must be zero for any epsilon of t when we use the equations of motion. Okay, because this is a legitimate variation. So delta S must be zero when we use equations of motion. That's called on shell. And then we argued because of that, you get a conservation law. Okay, so let's go back to the relativistic particle, and we have the action up there. And we're now going to infer the energy and the momentum. To do this, the easy way to do it is to go back to this formula and notice that our relativistic particle action is in exactly that form. So minus m naught c squared integral dt 1 minus dx dt squared over c squared. So the Lagrangian is minus m naught c squared square root 1 minus 1 over c squared dx dt squared. And so this is obviously translation invariant, right? If x goes to x plus epsilon, with epsilon a constant, since there's no explicit dependence on x, the Lagrangian is invariant and the action is invariant. So now we use Noether, and we see that p, which is dl dx dot, is equal to, so I've got to differentiate this with respect to x dot. I get a minus here, there's another minus from this. There's a factor of a half from the square root. It's a factor of 2 from the fact that this is squared. And so what I get is x dot over, I get m naught c squared, x dot over c squared, square root 1 minus x dot squared over c squared. And so this is m x dot over root 1 minus x dot squared over c squared. And so that's gamma m x dot, which is, And these are the spatial components of the four velocity, m naught here. These are the spatial components of the four velocity that we, four momentum that we discussed earlier. Now, what about time translation? Well, then we know the Hamiltonian is the conserved quantity. And so we'll just write that down. The Hamiltonian, so the energy, which is the Hamiltonian, is this momentum, P x dot minus the Lagrangian. So this is m naught, these are all m naughts, m naught x dot over root 1 minus x dot squared over c squared. This x dot gets multiplied by the by this x dot, so it's mx dot squared, minus the Lagrangian, which means it's plus m naught c squared square root 1 minus x dot squared over c squared. And so now if I multiply through by the square root, I'm going to get a minus x dot squared over c squared, which will cancel this term. And what I get is m naught c squared over root 1 minus x dot squared over c squared. And that, of course, is m naught m naught u naught. It's m naught c u naught. Okay, remember u naught or u mu was u mu was m naught times gamma, sorry, was gamma times c comma dx x dot. And so from this we see that the four momentum p mu, which is m naught u mu, is equal to e over c from this formula, comma p. So we see the time component of the four momentum is indeed the energy. And now we really have that the energy is m naught c squared over this factor. So E equals gamma m naught c squared. So that's the energy of a moving particle. Now, of course, if the particle couples to other things, like electromagnetic fields, its energy won't be conserved. It's only the total energy which will be conserved, the energy of the particle and the fields. But the beauty of the Noether derivation is for each term in the action, it will give you the corresponding contribution to the energy. So you will get the energy of the particle, you'll get the energy of the electromagnetic fields. The sum of them will be conserved, but you can just read off what are the individual contributions to the energy. It's useful to rewrite these equations in various ways. In relativistic mechanics, so you will remember that from the definition of the fall velocity, u mu, it follows that the square of it is minus 1. Right? Remember that d tau squared is minus or c squared, d tau squared, is minus dx mu, dx mu. And so it follows that, is minus c squared. So u mu is dx mu, d tau, satisfies u mu, u mu, u mu is minus c squared. And we also have, so p mu, which is m naught u mu, satisfies p mu equals m naught squared equals minus m naught squared c squared. And then this p mu is minus e squared over c squared, just using this formula here. P squared gives me minus e squared over c squared plus p squared. And so from this it follows that e squared equals c squared times p squared plus m naught squared c squared. And so again, E is approximately, we can take the square root of this equation. So E, which is equal to C times the square root of P squared plus M naught squared C squared, is approximately for P squared much less than M naught C. So if the particle's moving with small momentum, then the energy is m naught c squared plus p squared over 2 m naught, just the usual expression in Newtonian mechanics. Note also that since p is that P equals m naught v over root 1 minus v squared over c squared. OK, so here v is x dot, dx dt. So P equals gamma mv. You can solve this equation for v. And this implies that v equals P equals dx dt. Equals P over square root P squared plus M naught squared C squared. Okay, so the velocity of the particle is given in terms of its momentum by this formula. And notice that the magnitude of velocity is always less than 1. It's always less than C. I left out a C. There should be a C in here. So if you just solve this equation for V, so square it, and you can solve for V squared in terms of P squared, and then substitute back for V squared, and you'll get this formula. And so the velocity of the particle is always less than C. And what it's telling you is that if I have a particle and I accelerate it, well, the acceleration means I apply a force, and the force changes the momentum of the particle. But the most I can do is push the particle up to infinite momentum. But even if the momentum goes to infinity, the particle velocity remains less than the speed of light. Okay, so a massive particle cannot exceed the speed of light. And V equals C if, as P goes to, for P to infinity. Okay, so let us now, so we've dealt with electromagnetism, and we've dealt with particles. So now let's put the two together. Okay, so what we're going to consider is the action for a particle which moves along some world line, and it carries a charge Q. So what is its action going to be, the particle action? Is going to be integral, and then I have minus m naught c e to mu dx nu, and I want to couple this particle to electromagnetism. So how can I do that? What should the coupling be? The only thing I know about this particle is it has a trajectory, x mu of lambda. A little element of that trajectory is dx mu. Okay, and so that's the only thing I have to play with. A particle has dx mu. How am I going to couple that dx mu to electromagnetism in the action?
Tensor in some way?
Yeah, close. So Maxwell's theory is defined by this. Now, how can I couple this to dx mu? You see, I could try to write this down. What's that?
Zero.
Because this is symmetrical under mu tangent to nu. That, so this is zero. So we can't do that. What else could we do?
A mu,
exactly. So let's write down Q A mu dx mu. Okay, so this is the only possible way. There's nothing else you could write down. Okay, and that's correct. That is the coupling. And that describes the whole of electrodynamics of charged particles with electromagnetic fields. Of course, I use the fact that I've written it this way. Now let's go back to our action for the electromagnetic fields. Remember, the action for the electromagnetic fields was integral minus 1/4 f mu nu. It's a different integral because it's integral over all of spacetime. And then what I said, I believe, is j mu a mu. Right? So that gave the correct Maxwell equations when I varied with respect to a. So what do you know? This term looks just like that. Okay? It's linear in a mu. And so this tells us what the current is. That j mu for the particle is actually equal to that term. So j mu is equal to q. And now you see we have a problem because this is integrated along the particle world line, and this is integrated in spacetime. Okay, so the formula we need has to convert the one into the other. And let me just find my notes. Just don't want to get a sign wrong. J is Q integral d lambda dx mu d lambda delta function, four-dimensional delta function of x minus x of lambda. You see, if I plug this expression into the field action, let me just finish the argument. If I plug this expression into the field action, the four-dimensional delta function will integrate, and all it will do is force the argument of a mu, so this is a mu of x, it will force that argument to equal x of lambda, right? And then I'll be left with this lambda integral, which this is just the same as dx mu. I'll be left with this integral over the particle world line, and it will give exactly this term. Okay, yeah, what was your question?
So I've heard that the statement before that that is like the only thing you can write down.
Yes.
It seems like a pretty big statement.
It's a very big statement.
Can you prove that?
Yes. How? It's trivial.
How is it trivial?
All I have to play with is dx mu.
Okay.
And in the Maxwell side, all I have to play with is f mu nu and a mu. The only Lorentz invariant I could write down would be contracting the dx with a.
Why can't I contract 7 points?
You could square this. You could square this.
Yes.
Let me see. That does that make any sense? Doesn't really make any sense because this is so. The other requirement, yeah. The other requirement is that the action should be reparameterization invariant, because this lambda parameter shouldn't matter what it is, okay? And that forces this coupling to be linear in the dx. You see, if I write down dx mu d lambda, this doesn't depend on the lambda. I can reparameterize the line, and this doesn't change. But if I tried to write this down, then it's not reparameterization invariant. So the statement is that if you insist on reparameterization invariance, the action must be linear in the dx's. By the way, this is linear in the dx's because it's quadratic, but then with a square root. So now I'm thinking, why can't we write down this? Dx mu d lambda, a nu dx nu d lambda, square rooted. Maybe we can. Let's see.
It's obvious.
No, that's not a good enough reason.
It isn't. Okay,
so now I'm going to use another symmetry, okay, which is that. So imposing reparameterization invariance in lambda.
Are you taking the square root of a square?
That's equal to, of course, the modulus. Yeah, which amounts to the same thing. You're right. But let's see.
You can just add something like.
Yeah.
You know,
no, it's true. I don't. That's not independent. I mean, if I put the modulus, it doesn't really change.
Why can't you multiply by f squared, for example? Like this term.
You could. There's nothing to stop you putting an f squared here. Okay.
Yeah.
So that would be fine. This would be x squared computed on the line.
Okay.
I can give several arguments against that. One of which would be the dimensions of this is all wrong now, because f has dimensions. And so you would have to divide this by some scale to make f has dimensions. You see, we can get the dimensions of f from the action. So f obviously has, well, we can't because I put the mu naught in here. Let me not go too much into that. But basically, in particle physics units, the f has dimensions of mass squared. And you ignore this mu naught. And f has dimensions of mass squared, and this has mass to the minus 4. That's how the dimensions work out for the action in particle physics units. And so here you would need some scale to the fourth power to cancel the dimensions of the f. Okay, so you would argue that if I'm at low energies, well below the scale, this term is irrelevant. Okay, so that's a sort of typical effective field theory argument. There are other reasons why, I think you can do that, but you would have to introduce another scale, and then at energies much smaller than that scale, you wouldn't see the effect. Good.
But you say that people can prove this, but you seem to be using very, very different arguments against different...
Oh, I'm only saying all I can prove is if I have this quantity, and that's all I have, then the only Lorentz invariant I can construct is the inner product. That's easy to show.
But no, because like you can just add the F squared.
No. If all I have is these two quantities, only Lorentz invariant which I can construct out, well, of course I can do this.
You can add an A squared.
Or I can do this, right? But these don't involve X and A. The only invariant way to combine dx and A is in this form. This is the only Lorentz invariant I can construct out of those two quantities.
Well, what you wrote down there is Lorentz invariant.
But this doesn't involve it in this.
No, the A mu, dx nu, that's Lorentz invariant.
Yes, it
and
is.
You have to use another argument of it being having to be linear. And if you want to add something else, you have to.
Well, you see, again, I would say. So.
It seems like you should be able to write down some conditions that your term has to satisfy.
I will leave that to you as an exercise. I will leave that to you as an exercise. If I involve this.
This looks very involved to prove that that is the only possible thing you can write down.
It is the only possible, it is the only possible coupling, which is, so let me try to make it a bit more clear, which one introduces no other scale, no additional scale. Okay, so if I do something like this, to get the dimensions right, I'm going to have to just divide by some scale. A mu has dimensions of mass. Okay. So that's excluded.
What do you mean by introduced? Because I already have a mass that I can use.
No, there's a particular dimension of the action.
Yeah, but I already have a mass there, m0. You say introduce a new scale, I already have a scale.
Okay, so I could write this thing down over m0 squared. Why would I choose m0? I mean, it could be anything.
You need a scale, and I can't introduce it.
The statement is that if I'm discussing physics at energies smaller than the scale, this term would be small. If the a mu is smaller than m0, I can ignore such terms. These are good questions, but let's not get stuck on this.
Who says that nature doesn't work like that? Who says that there isn't a third term which looks like that for a very high mass?
Simplest. Okay. Okay. I don't want to fight about it. That term with a mu, of course, would be problematic anyway, because it's not gauge invariant. Okay, so you can bring other principles into the game. You can use reparametrization invariance to say it's linear in dx. You can bring gauge invariance. Remember, gauge invariance is that if a mu goes to a mu plus a derivative, chi, with chi any function, the Maxwell action was invariant because it depends only on f. And so if you want to maintain this as an invariance of the combined action, this actually works. Okay, why? Because with this term, you get into the change in the action would be d mu chi dx mu, which is a surface term. Okay, and so a gauge transformation does not change, it leaves the action invariant up to surface terms. So that is gauge invariant. This would not be gauge invariant. Okay. So let us now vary the action. So S is equal to, well, I've got this action out here. Well, let's just vary it. And so delta S is equal to, I'm going to vary with respect to x. And so delta S is equal to minus m naught c. I've got to vary this guy. So what I do, I get a minus sign from here, inverse square root . Then I've got to vary this guy, so I have I get a factor of 2, like half from the square root, 2 from varying this. So in the numerator, I have eta mu nu dx mu d delta x mu. Okay. And if you want, you could put all the lambdas in, the d lambdas in, but you don't really need them. And then, as usual, we're going to integrate by parts to make this depend only on the variation delta x. When I vary this guy, I get q a mu d delta x mu. Okay, so both of these terms I integrate by parts. Before we do that, it is useful to rewrite this as m naught c eta mu nu dx mu d delta x mu d tau.
Should those be dx d delta x mu's?
Sorry. These are, oh, you're right. Thank you. Here, right?
Yeah.
The other one I have right.
Yeah, and then in what you wrote underneath there.
Oh, I see. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, so actually, let me write it this way. Integral, I'm going to introduce proper time, and I'm going to put a d tau. In the numerator and the denominator in that term. And then, of course, this is d of delta x nu by d tau. This is d tau. I've got a c wrong somewhere. So that c is gone. Because this thing is actually c d tau. OK, so that's the first term. And then the second term is q. Oh, sorry, I haven't done that right. When I varied the action, when I varied the action, I should have first varied this guy, q d nu a mu delta x nu, right? That's the variation of a mu with, and then I have a dx mu. And then I have an extra term, which is plus q a mu d delta x mu. Okay, so now I'm going to multiply with tau and divide by, multiply with d tau and divide by d tau. So I have d nu a mu dx mu d tau delta x nu plus q a mu d delta x nu mu d tau. I won't use that one. Okay, so I introduced this d tau. Now I'm going to integrate by parts to remove the derivatives on the delta x variation. And so what I've got is minus integral d tau delta x mu m naught d2 x mu d tau squared. I've just used the fact that this eta times x lowers the index, and I've changed the index from nu to mu. Let's put the minus here. And then in this term, well, this term is already in a good form. So I have plus d, but I need to relabel the index. So mu a nu dx nu d tau delta x mu to make it the same as this index. And then the last term, I integrate by parts and get a minus sign q. Differentiating a mu with respect to tau, remember a mu is a function of x, and x is a function of tau. It's the x for the particle where it is. Okay, so really we have a mu of x of tau. Okay, so when you integrate by parts and differentiate, you're going to get d nu a mu dx nu d tau times delta x mu. And so this should be 0 for all delta x mu. And so that forces m d2 x mu d tau squared to equal this guy, q d mu a nu minus d nu a mu. So this is f mu nu dx nu d tau. Okay, so that's the equation of motion for the particle. And does that remind you of anything? It's the Lorentz force. Okay, so let's see that. If I take, and again, you see, I mean, up to certain caveats, you could argue that this is the only thing you could write down in the equation of motion, right? So if I want the equation of motion to only be expressed in terms of F, why? Because there is this gauge invariance, and so I would like all physical things only to be, the only physical thing is F. So if all that can appear in the equation of motion is F, and And then I've got to construct some Lorentz invariant vector, well, some Lorentz four vector. This is a four vector. Tau is invariant. X transforms under Lorentz transformation. So this is a four vector. F is a four tensor. This is a four vector. So this is also a four vector. So this is clearly Lorentz invariant, and up to various caveats, it's the only thing you could write down. Okay, so let's just check that. To do that, let us in particular, sorry, this is M naught. P, let's look at the spatial components of the four momentum.
I have a question.
Yes.
Why is there like one upper index on the left side and one lower?
Because I'm wrong. Thank you. We should have seen that here somehow. You see, yes, the way I derived it, this index was down, and this would have been down. But you're free to raise and lower those two indices. Thank you. Okay, so the four, if we take the four momentum, and just take its three, its spatial components, then this is equal to M naught d x I d tau. Right? That was the definition of the four momentum. So what this equation is telling us is that d by d tau of pi is equal to q, and now I take the index I, and remember that fi0 is ei. Now I have to care about if that index is up or down. I think down, so fi0. Just have to worry about a minus sign if the depending on whether the zero index is up or down, okay? Fi0 is ei, if I'm right. And Fij is epsilon ijk bk. And so what we have here are two terms. We have q fij dxi d tau plus F0, what am I doing? Fi0 dx0 d tau. Okay?
Is that dxj d tau on the first one?
Yes, thank you. So let me lower these indices just so it gets less confusing. Raising and lowering spatial indices really does nothing, since you're just using the Kronecker delta to do that. And then use this formula. So this is q times the electric field. This is this term. Times dt d tau. Actually, dct d tau. And then this term comes over here. And it gives me epsilon ijk dxj. I'm going to write it this way, dxj dt dt d tau. Just make sure I've got the dimensions right. I think they're right. Times b k. Okay, so now I can rewrite all of this. You see, I've extracted the let me just see. I think I'm missing a
EI over C.
My C is confusing me. Oh, of course, it's EI over C. Thank you. All right, the C will cancel there. Good. So this now becomes Q. So you see, I have dt d tau here, I have dt d tau there. Multiply through by dt, by, divide through by dt d tau, that will convert this into a d by dt. So what I infer is that d by dt of pi is q ei plus epsilon ijk vj bk. This is the velocity. V is dx dt. And so that's exactly the Lorentz force law. OK, so the Lorentz force law is relativistically correct, providing you interpret the left-hand side as the spatial components of the four momentum, and this and the right-hand side is the usual Lorentz force. OK, but notice that it's t which appears there, not tau. Okay, any questions? So I think all of this must have been a great revelation in the early part of the 20th century, in the 1900s, or maybe it was the 1890s, when Lorentz and other people were figuring out the rules of relativity and the symmetry. And they suddenly realized that these very complex equations Maxwell had written down were actually extremely simple in this notation. So what I want to end today with is a sort of transition to general relativity. And basically discuss how we go from Lorentz symmetry to more general changes of coordinates. So let's recall the Lorentz transformations were defined to obey lambda mu alpha lambda nu beta, eta mu nu is eta alpha beta. It's not difficult to count how many dimensions is this, count the dimensionality of the space of these lambdas. Well, let me say before that, if I had an orthogonal group with 4x4 matrices, for 4x4 matrix O, this would be the group O4. Okay, that's the definition of the group O4. 4x4 real matrices satisfying this equation. And do you know what the dimension of that group is? How big is that group? How many independent parameters specify such a matrix? Well, let's do O3. Do you know how many are O3? So we talk about rotations in three dimensions. There are the Euler angles, right? And there are three of them, three independent angles. When we go to four dimensions, how many? Yeah. Six is exactly right, so six dimensions. This is a six-dimensional, we call it a Lie group. Lie just means its parameters are continuous. And you can see that from this equation, that it's six-dimensional, because ask yourself, so if I have a matrix O, which is 4x4, this would naively have 16 parameters. right? An arbitrary 4x4 matrix has 16 independent components, so it has 16 parameters. How many equations do I really have here? Okay, so think about this equation. Well, the left-hand side has two indices, right? It is symmetric, because if I transpose this, I get exactly the same back. So it's symmetric. So it is it's a set of equations which are symmetric under I and J. Now, how many components does a symmetric 4x4 matrix have? Okay, so just think about a symmetric 4x4 matrix. Well, you can put anything on the diagonal, so there are four. And you could put something off the diagonal, six elements off the diagonal, and then over here it's just the same because it's symmetric. So you get 10 parameters, right? So this is really 10 equations. Okay, so I've got 16 parameters constrained by 10 equations. It leaves me with six free parameters. But OTO equals 1 is 10 equations. And so we're left with six free parameters. So the same is going to be true here. This is not O4 because it's not quite that equation. This one is lambda eta lambda transpose equals eta. It would be that equation if we replaced eta with the Kronecker delta symbol, with unity. But that critical minus sign is important. And this makes the group O3, 1. That's the way we usually write it, that it's as far as the IJK indices go, the eta symbol is just the Kronecker delta. Mm-hmm. So this includes the rotations, O3, 3x3 rotations. But it's basically a version of O4 with a critical minus sign in it. So this is the definition of the group, the Lie group O3, 1. Same argument there. It has six parameters. Okay, so the Lorentz group is a six-dimensional group. And we have defined the transformation. Well, let's see. Electromagnetism or electrodynamics. We have seen that electrodynamics of fields and particles is invariant under x mu going to x mu prime equals lambda mu nu x nu. And then actually, this has sort of been implicit. We can also translate x by a constant. Okay, because the theory only involves derivatives. And so all the actions we have written down are unchanged if I take the coordinates and shift them by a constant. So this combination, this is called a Lorentz group. This is called a translation group. And the combination, does anyone know its name? Poincaré group. So this is Poincaré group. And this is 10-dimensional. Okay, the four translations and six Lorentz transformations. The six Lorentz transformations include three rotations and three boosts. I can boost in x, y, and z, and I can rotate around the x, y, or z axes. And so the Poincaré group is 10-dimensional. Now, I want to just finish by showing you that the Poincaré group is actually the most general group of coordinate transformations which preserve the eta symbol. So it tells you there's really nothing, as long as you insist on invariance of the eta, then there's nothing else to consider. Okay, so let us consider a more general coordinate transformation, or actually a completely general coordinate transformation. See, the Poincaré was very special. It's linear. Poincaré coordinate transformation is linear, but let's consider a general coordinate transformation. X mu goes to X prime mu, which can be any function at all of X. Okay, why not? Why should we restrict to linear functions in the space-time coordinates? So let's consider the most a completely general transformation. And this was partly the logic which Einstein followed to construct general relativity. It's just to generalize electrodynamics by generalizing the Lorentz transformations. So it follows that dx prime mu is equal to dx prime mu dx nu dx nu. Okay, so in general, this quantity takes the place of the Lorentz transformation. So instead of lambda mu nu dx nu. And of course, for the derivative, d by dx prime mu, this just goes the other way by the chain rule. Okay, so you see that the displacement dx mu transforms with the Jacobian matrix, and the derivative transforms with the inverse Jacobian matrix. To see this is the inverse, just note that dx prime mu dx nu dx nu dx prime alpha. What is that equal to? Well, this is nothing but the expression for dx prime mu dx prime alpha, right? By the chain rule. And so if I differentiate the coordinate with respect to itself, I get exactly the Kronecker delta, right? Because when I differentiate time with respect to time, I get 1. X with respect to X, I get 1. Everything else, I get 0. So this matrix is the inverse of that. And this is how all the tensors are going to transform. Everything with an upstairs index will go with the Jacobian. Everything with the downstairs index will go with this guy. This replaces lambda. This replaces lambda tilde. OK? And so let us show that, or let's say we can show that invariance of eta implies Poincaré. Okay, so what do I mean by that? Invariance of eta, I mean the equation that eta alpha beta got a bit lost. Lost a page. Never mind. Never mind. We'll just do it. Eta alpha beta should be. Dx prime alpha dx mu dx prime beta dx nu eta mu nu. So I want to assume that my x transformation satisfies this equation. And from this equation alone, I want to prove that x prime mu must be of that form, must be of the Poincaré form. Okay, so let me see. Let me just relabel these indices to get it into a convenient form. Yes, in fact, sorry, I'm going to write it the other way. Eta, you can easily show this is implied by the other one. Just invert the dx prime. So d alpha dx prime alpha dx epsilon dx prime beta dx delta equals eta epsilon delta. Okay, I want to start from that equation. As I said, I could get the other equation just by inverting. Eta upstairs is the inverse of eta downstairs, and inverting these matrices. Have I got this right? Let me just see. Sorry, I'm a little. Sorry, I'm just confused at the primes being. Yes, I think they should.
Well, it actually doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter because you can invert, right? So So if I multiply this by dx epsilon dx. Wait a second. I'm not sure that's true. Okay, let me just think about this. Yeah, I think it is true, right? So if I multiply this by dx prime, if I multiply this by dx prime, let's not worry about indices, right? And then I multiply this side by dx dx prime, that will simply remove these factors, right? So I'll get eta is eta dx dx prime, and this is the correct transformation law for eta. Okay, so it's completely equivalent, which to write the original one or to write it the way I did. And the way I did is just more convenient for the algebra. So dx prime alpha, dx epsilon, dx prime beta, dx delta. Is that okay? Everybody happy with that? I know. Thanks. Okay, let us go through this in lightning speed. If I take this equation and write, so now comes a very clever trick. And by the way, this is the trick which Riemann invented in setting up Riemannian geometry. He did lots of algebraic tricks. And this one we're going to see many, many times in this course. It's the same trick. So what we do is and it's very counterintuitive. You take that equation and differentiate it with respect to, okay, sorry, let me just make sure I've got my indices right. I think that's right. Sorry about this. I think let me do it at the beginning of the next lecture. Just worried my indices don't match up. I'll do it at the beginning of the next lecture. So I believe it's in the notes. I'm not convinced the indices are in the right place. Okay. So I will do it at the beginning of the next lecture. But that's kind of a remarkable statement, that simply imposing invariance of the eta can be shown to imply that x prime has to be linear in the x's. Okay, and then of course we are going to remove this equation. When we do GR, we're going to remove this equation. And we're going to go to much more general coordinate transformations. Okay, any quick questions? If not, I shall see you next Monday. And from then on, it'll be a slower pace. Okay, so have a good few days.